This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And it is super. The sky is clear today, and it looks like a great day overall. Today, we're going to be talking a lot about heart disease. As many of you know, this is Heart Health Awareness Month. And typically on one of the shows in this month, we like to emphasize heart disease. And it's kind of interesting because in doing some reading, historically, I read something that really made this so important from the standpoint that in many ancient languages, references to the heart are references to the very core of what it means to be human. The heart is the seat of intellect, morality, physical health, imagination, and emotion. So throughout time, the heart has had a very special place among organs. So that's why I think it's so important for us to chat about that today. My guest today is going to be Dr. Stephanie Saucier. Dr. Saucier is a medical doctor, and she is director of Women's Health and Wellness at Hartford Healthcare. And it's an interesting program, and we're going to talk about heart disease in general, but particularly how it applies to women and the things we can do to really stay healthier and keep ourselves in better condition overall and avoid heart disease. This day in medicine, February 17th, in 1781, Dr. René Laennec was born. Dr. Laennec was a French physician. But in 1819, he recorded the discovery of the stethoscope. So again, here we are in Heart Health Awareness Month, and we're talking about the anniversary of the birth of the man who came up with it. Now, a stethoscope hasn't really changed an awful lot. I mean, originally, it was kind of a bell tube that was able to pick up sounds in the heart and differentiate them with each heartbeat. We still do that today. And as much as we've gone to maybe better materials in stethoscopes, and there are some that look at it very differently from the standpoint of analyzing things and computerization, but for the most part, the stethoscope that we all carry is pretty much the same basic principle that Dr. Laennec put together back in 1819. So, again, we remember him. Also today, February 17th in 1845, Dr. Charles McBurney was born. Now, Dr. McBurney was a surgeon in New York who pioneered a lot of abdominal surgery. And he identified the point of maximal tenderness in appendicitis. So it's called McBurney's point. And you'll still see that reference today when someone does an abdominal examination and they expect someone may have appendicitis, they will make a note as to what the patient's response was to putting pressure on McBurney's point. So we remember those two physicians today. One of the things I wanted to talk about last week and actually didn't get to, but is medical scams. There are so many out there. And why? Because we spend so much time worried about our health and why trying to promote better health. And in many cases, we're looking for a quick fix. And many people have unscrupulously gotten into this, okay? So one of the things I was just reading about was the use of the essential oil market, right? There are people out there selling you on essential oils. Now, I don't have a hard time with people using oils or scents if it relaxes them, burning candles, incense, whatever it may be, if it makes them feel better. But there's also a line that can't be crossed. Many of these essential oils are not made to be taken internally. They are not made to be taken intravenously. They are not the sole cure for things like cancer. Now, they'll say in their ads, we don't say we can cure cancer, but we have my friend and one of my clients had cancer, and it was gone after she or he used this oil, okay? So again, it's literally snake oil in many cases. And many of these operations are built on multi-tiered marketing. Now, I love the way they use the term multi-tiered. Many of us know of it as a pyramid, okay? But they don't like to use that. Sometimes they use the hub and spoke way of doing this. And again, I have nothing against products that don't hurt people, okay? And even if there isn't really good proof of benefit, as long as it doesn't hurt them either financially or physically, I don't have a problem with it. What I appreciate is when a patient comes to me and says, what do you think of this? And I can sit there and explain the pros and cons of doing that and using this device. But with the multi-tiered idea, let's face it, multi-tiered pyramids, they're a way of doing business, right? Whether you're buying insurance from someone, someone up the ladder is getting a piece of that, someone who you may or may never know, okay? The point here is that the person you're buying it from is not on the hook. Let me explain again. With many of these products, whether it be oils, as I mentioned, but it could be any. It could have been Amway. It could have been any number of things. People at the bottom of the tier are obligated to buy a certain amount of the product, whether they can sell it or not. So if it's based on the fact that I'm going to sell something to someone, now I have to buy it from someone higher on the tier, okay, that's the way business is done. But to obligate these folks to keep buying every month product that they cannot move, cannot sell, is where they get into a lot of different problems, and it really can bankrupt somebody. The other thing they often say with these products is the reason you haven't heard about this is because it's not part of Big Pharma. Guess what? They are Big Pharma. These are billion-dollar industries now. Okay? So they are right there with what they have focused on as Big Pharma. And they also try to get people to not discuss these therapies with their doctors. Okay, and I think it's because we're going to, we take an oath, right, to do what's best for our patients, to help them stay healthy. So as long as I don't have a financial interest in this, okay, I should be able to give you an objective view of what is best for you or what is not best for you. So with that, I don't say don't try these things, but there are other companies out there. And let me tell you, they are aggressive. A recent product that was recently a colleague expressed some, I don't know, just disagreement with, we'll say. A certain product they mentioned that they didn't think was a good product for athletes to use. Within hours, she got a call from a doctor, a medical doctor, who is on the advisory board. Okay, another key, advisory board means they're getting paid by the company to help promote this device that she didn't think was helpful. And because of that, so within hours gets a phone call, and within days gets a lawyer gets a cease and desist order just because you mentioned that this thing may not work. And in fact, when you look at the data, there's no data to support it does work. Now, people are using the device, okay. But in her estimate, she wouldn't advise an athlete to use this device. And it's been any number of things. They're out there. There are certain mouth guards that people are saying will stop concussion and things such as that. So we see this all the time. So they're out there. Please be careful when you're considering any of these devices. Next thing I wanted to chat about was the CDC has now loosened its recommendations regarding isolation if you test positive for COVID. Let's be clear. That doesn't mean that if you're really sick, you go to work. They're just saying, let's start using some common sense. If you had the flu or you had anything else, if you wouldn't go to work, don't. Because you may be contagious. So if you test positive, but you feel fine, and maybe over the next 24 hours you're getting better, you don't have a fever, okay? If you have a fever, you stay home. If you're starting to feel worse as the day goes on or as days goes on, stay home. But if all you have are some mild symptoms after testing positive and you feel well, go to work. But wear a mask, okay, just in case you might be contagious. Don't be afraid to wear a mask. Because then we get into the field of sick shaming. There's a new one for many of us, sick shaming, where if someone is going to work and sneezing and coughing, no one wants to be near them. Kind of understandable. But by the same token, there are employers who expect you to go to work even when you're not feeling well. So you can often be stuck in the middle. If you're sneezing and coughing a lot, no matter what it is, okay, even if it's got nothing to do with COVID, okay, put a mask on when you're around people in close contact because it makes everybody more comfortable. And I'm hoping masks have gradually become more commonplace. As I've seen on recent trips, wearing a mask on an airplane, wearing a mask in an elevator is not a bad thing. Always keep one handy. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Stephanie Saucier, and we're going to be talking about cardiology. Now, if you need to get in touch with me during the show, just email me at info@alessimd.com, and I'll be happy to pose your question to Dr. Saucier. So, again, we're going to take a short break. Back with Dr. Stephanie Saucier. We're talking about heart disease in favor of Heart Health Awareness Month. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to have with me my guest today, Dr. Stephanie Saucier. Dr. Saucier is director of the Women's Heart and Wellness Program at Hartford Healthcare. She is a board-certified cardiologist and someone who is extremely knowledgeable and a great resource for cardiac issues. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tony.
So, Stephanie, give everybody kind of a snapshot of your background. How did you get here and what you do?
You know, I really fell in love with medicine when I was very young. When I was in eighth grade when I decided I'm going to be a cardiologist and I'm going to try to help someone else's mom, dad, and loved one. And so my path to medicine really started very young. I then went to my undergrad at Quinnipiac University, and I completed medical school at Rush University. I subsequently did an internal medicine residency with the University of Connecticut here, and I continued on and did a fellowship in cardiovascular disease, also with the University of Connecticut at Hartford Hospital. From there, I really, you know, had such a passion for cardiology and preventive cardiology, and I also had this special interest in heart disease in women because of all of the kind of misinformation out there in regards to cardiac disease in women. And, you know, the fact that that is a special population. So I became a board certified lipid specialist in addition to a general cardiologist. And I've been working here at Hartford Healthcare, building the Women's Heart Program, running cardiac rehab, and also, like I said, practicing as a non-invasive cardiologist for the past 4 years as an attending now.
Stephanie, I got to ask you, what happened at age 8? Was there an incident or something someone told you, something you read? Because that's pretty rare that you decided that at such an early age not only to go to medical school but to specialize in cardiology. Lord knows many of us changed our minds several times along the way.
Yeah, you know, it was. My mother, unfortunately, was in a very serious car accident at that time in my life. And she, you know, I was in eighth grade, and just I was really impressed by the doctors and the nurses and the medical staff that saved her life and, you know, was able to give me back my mom. And so it sparked that passion right there to say, I need to help other people and I really need to try to make a difference. And so that's where the passion for medicine came in. And, you know, Tony, it is true. I think there were times that I waffled on what type of medicine in my early training. But then cardiology just, to me, it makes the most sense, right? It makes a lot of sense. It's the heartbeat to our life, and without it, we are nothing. And so I loved that cardiology was just such an equalizer, and people from all walks of life suffer from heart disease. It's quite preventable, and I think that also really inspired me, is that a lot of heart disease can actually be prevented. So you can prevent things from happening to people that may affect them. And so that, you know, so a really personal story, and I'm blessed to have my mom, you know, here, and I'm doing amazing. She's my number one fan. I always say that. But that's kind of where my passion came from.
Wow. In a couple of minutes, since we're getting ready for the bottom of the hour, can you kind of define the scope of heart disease? When we hear about heart disease, what are we talking about?
So most people, you know, it's a complex thing, but, you know, most heart disease is, we're talking about coronary artery disease or blockages in the arteries of the heart. But that's not it. There's also a number of different types of heart disease, including irregular heart rhythms or heart failure. And so it's important that when you're talking about heart disease, that we're talking about all different types of heart disease. But the most common is coronary artery disease. And so that's typically what people hear about and know about. And there's also genetic heart diseases that occur. There's valvular heart disease. And so the heart is made up of a lot of different parts. And so if one of those is broken, then you have a form of heart disease.
And I'm assuming the most common thing you deal with is ischemic heart disease more than anything else?
Yes, that's the most common. That's what we call coronary artery disease or ischemic heart disease. When you have someone who has a heart attack, they're suffering from ischemic heart disease or coronary artery disease. And so that's the most common type of heart disease that cardiologists and providers will deal with day to day.
We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Stephanie Saucier, who is the Director of Women's Health and Wellness at Hartford Healthcare. Well, we really want to get into framing the problem of heart disease and really talking about the risk factors. And more importantly, what should we be doing to find out if we have heart disease? What is the appropriate workup? Because that keeps changing in terms of blood tests, lipids, calcium scores. And then what are we going to do to avoid it? If you want questions for me, you can get them at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and my guest today is Dr. Stephanie Saucier, who is a cardiologist and the Director of Women's Health and Wellness at Hartford Healthcare. If you wish to contact Dr. Saucier, the best phone number is 860-972-1695. If you wish to set up an appointment for evaluation of cardiac disease. Stephanie, let's get back to it. I really want to frame the problem. And I've heard it said that heart disease kills more women than all forms of cancer combined. Is that true?
That is true. So heart disease is the number one killer of women. You know, these days, we're really blessed that women are surviving breast cancer. They're surviving other illnesses. The problem is they're still dying most from heart disease. And so it's so important that we have that knowledge that this is the number one killer. And a lot of people just don't know that.
So when we look at this, and when we look at heart disease and different types of heart disease, let's, if we were to stick with ischemic heart disease, let's talk about the biggest risk factors. What put more men and women at risk for heart disease?
Absolutely. So the risk factors for heart disease are, you know, really a lot of them are things that you can manage. So number one is lipids. When you have high cholesterol, it allows that plaque or that cholesterol to build up in the arteries of the heart, arteries in the brain, and, you know, and especially in the heart. And that's what we find when we have ischemic heart disease. It's that buildup of cholesterol and plaque that gets calcified in the arteries of the heart that then ruptures and causes a heart attack. So having high cholesterol is one of the most important risk factors. Another really important risk factor is smoking. And so smoking, what it does is it causes inflammation of the arteries of the heart, and plaque and cholesterol love inflammation. It's an area that they just go to and it builds up. And then again, that's how, as the arteries get narrower and narrower and blockages get more tight, that's what causes heart disease. And if those plaques rupture, that's what causes a heart attack. So lipids first, high cholesterol is a really important risk factor. Smoking is a really important risk factor. High blood pressure that's not well treated is a very important risk factor. Diabetes is another risk factor. So if your sugar levels are not well controlled, that can also lead to damage of those coronary arteries. And again, promote this buildup of calcified plaque that then can rupture, or the buildup of soft plaques. So a lot of the risk factors for heart disease are things that you hear of all of the time. Oh, I have high blood pressure, or oh, I have high cholesterol, or oh, you know, I have diabetes. And it's managing those risk factors that allow us to help prevent heart disease from occurring. And quitting smoking is number one. You know, we always say now people are moving towards these e-cigarettes and the vaping, which we hear a lot about. And guess what? Unfortunately, that's not any better for people. And so we're learning that as research and data comes out, that any form of smoking is bad, still bad for your heart.
Are we winning that battle yet as far as smoking? I mean, we've made great strides, obviously, in the last 50 or 60 years, but are we still fighting a losing battle?
You know, I think, Tony, it's interesting because we have seen a decrease, obviously, in smokers, especially in the United States. However, we're seeing an influx of younger adults start vaping and using nicotine products. And so I wonder, you know, where that trade-off is going to be. So people aren't necessarily going out and buying packs of cigarettes as much, but the vaping industry and the e-cigarette industry is, you know, is still growing, especially in that, those younger populations. So I think it's important that we still get out there, hey, this is a big risk factor for developing heart disease. You know, you don't want to do any form of smoking. So it's hard to say. I think we may be trading one for another, but it's definitely something that we talk about with all of our patients.
So you mentioned cholesterol, but, you know, it's not that simple anymore, right? So when you get your blood work back, you've got to deal with what your HDLs are, your LDLs. Can you drill down on the whole lipid thing for everybody? Because for many, I'm sure it's a review, but it's become, and there are always new studies, right? What was your lipid pattern? What is your beta lipoprotein A? So can you kind of give us the simplified version of what we need to know?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's some numbers that you just need to know. Your total cholesterol is usually the number a lot of people know. That is your HDL plus your LDL plus 20% of your triglycerides. So that's how we calculate a total cholesterol. It's important to know what our HDL is, which is your good cholesterol, what your triglycerides are, and then what your LDL is. Now, your LDL-C, that's really the one that we focus on a lot. And that number is really important in people who are trying to modify their risk for coronary disease. It's also important that people are getting their lipoprotein A or their LP little a tested. because we know that LP little a is an independent risk factor for heart disease, and it affects one in five people, or 20% of the population, have high LP little a, but they don't know about it. And so, you know, as to speaking out to kind of the public of what numbers you need to know, you know, ask your doctor, what's my LP little a? Ask your doctor, what's your LDL? And, you know, triglycerides are a really important marker for development of diabetes down the line. And so I always think it's important also to know what your triglyceride levels are. But those are the big numbers, you know, getting into the particle sizes and, you know, the different makeups of cholesterol. We can get really in depth. And as a lipid specialist, we do this often. But I think what people need to know is what your LDL is, what your triglycerides are, and what that LP little a is. Those are the most important.
When you study some of these, like the LPL double a, little a, is that something you do regularly, or is it just you do once in your lifetime to find out where you are in this?
You know, so it's something that you do once in your lifetime. Now, if it is elevated, you may need it to be tested based on treatments and based on other things that we're doing, you know, as your doctor. But the LP little a, it reaches its adult level by the age of 5. And so most people have had this, it's a genetically determined level, and they've either had a high LP little a or a normal LP little a for most of their adult life. And so getting it tested once, if it's totally normal, you can kind of just put that in the back of the books and keep on moving. There's some new research, though, specifically in women, looking at LP little a levels that are increasing after menopause. So there's some argument within the, not argument, but there's some discussion still within the lipid community that should we be testing women over the age of 50 for their LP little a again or a second time? But for most people, currently we say get it tested once in your lifetime.
You know, I hate to bring this topic up, but since we're on it, okay, I'm going to use the dirty word statins, okay, because people think, right, I mean, there is no drug that I think that has singly saved more lives from cerebrovascular and cardiovascular disease that has been so vilified in the press. Can you talk a little bit about how statins work and why they have made such a huge difference?
Absolutely. So, you know, I agree with you. Statins really have been the cornerstone at saving lives for many, many years. You know, yes, we have new drugs that are coming out, but statins are still the backbone of decreasing morbidity and mortality. And mortality is death, right? And to me, that's a very hard endpoint. It's like if you're decreasing the amount of people who are dying, then we're doing something good. So what statins do is statins decrease the production of cholesterol in the liver. And so by decreasing the production of cholesterol in the liver, we then in turn upregulate those LDL receptors on the liver that pull out the bad cholesterol from the circulating blood and allow those LDL numbers to come down. Now, statins don't just work on the LDL, but they've also been shown to decrease your high sensitivity CRP, which is an inflammatory marker, and stabilize plaque that you may already have. And stable plaque is always better than unstable plaque. And so statins work on so many levels of protecting someone who either has heart disease or has had a stroke and, you know, preventing them from having future disease. They've been around for many, many years. And unfortunately, you're right, they have been vilified. And I think that comes because about 10% of people who take statins, you know, get muscle aches, pains, or weaknesses, and they don't tolerate it. Now, that's not everyone. 90% of people take these medications and do just fine. There are no, you know, very, very rare, any serious side effects. And again, the safety profile, these drugs have been around for over 30 years. So taking them long term, we know is healthy. We know it's safe. But not everyone can take them. And so that's, I think, where that vilification comes from is everyone, you know, if 10% of people get these muscle aches and pains, you're in a room of 100 people, you know, you're going to know 10 people in that room who didn't like statins or who didn't tolerate them. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we can't use other medications, right? Because there's new medications coming out in the market. But we know that statins decrease your risk of having a recurrent heart attack or stroke. And so they can lower your LDL-C by 50% if the high intensity statins are being used, which are huge numbers. You know, we don't get some of that reduction from some other medications or from some supplements that people may take. And so, you know, I like to encourage patients to give them a chance, right? Don't be fearful. You know, there's things that we can do if you do, if you're one of the 10% that don't tolerate a statin, we can help you. And we have other tips and tricks and techniques out there nowadays, but they still are our backbone and they do prevent you, you know, ultimately from dying or having another heart attack or stroke. So they're still my go-to, you know, first line for everything.
I have a question that just came in from Paul, and it says, I'm bothered to buy the book Sickening. Most people I know take a statin. After reading this book, I'm convinced that they are overprescribed. When my physician told me that I have a 7.5% chance of a cardiac event and recommended one, it was well before I read this book. That percentage is kind of ridiculous to me. What is your view on this book, if you've read it, or on statins? I was 61 at the time. I'm now 65. So I think, is that 7.5% chance significant?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and there's a lot of details in here, Paul, to answer your question. So number one, the 7.5% puts someone who anyone who has a 10-year ASCVD risk or a 10-year risk of having a heart attack or stroke of 7.5%, that's an intermediate risk. Now, that number, that percentage goes up based off of your blood pressure, your cholesterol, your age. And so that risk does increase as you get older. Now, more than 20% we consider high risk, but 7.5% we consider intermediate risk. And based off of that, you know, a lot of the recommendations is if you're at intermediate risk and you're hesitant to maybe start a statin, then progressing to a coronary calcium score is actually a really good option, because then we can see, do you actually already have calcified plaque in the arteries of the heart? Because if you do, then we're no longer preventing plaque from developing. You already have it. We're preventing plaque from getting worse, or plaque from rupturing and causing a heart attack. And so I think there's a difference between what we call primary prevention, where people don't have anything or they're low risk, so they have a less than 7.5% risk, and people who have that intermediate risk or high risk. So to answer your question, I think that the 10-year ASCVD risk calculator, it's not perfect. There are better, there are newer ones that are coming out, but it is still a really good estimate of what your risk is. And if you're in an intermediate risk, then we might want to consider doing something more, like I said, like a calcium score. I think that the clinical research on statins preventing dying and preventing future heart attacks and strokes is just too strong. You know, I think that every patient is unique and an individual, and we have to take all of your history, you know, as one. But I think to say no one should be on a statin and they're overprescribed, I think is a little, you know, not the right answer. And the reason why I say that is because heart disease, both in men and women, still is the number one killer of all Americans and all people. And so we obviously have to try to fix that. We have to try to correct that. And so we have great data showing that statins reduce your risk of dying. So let's use that tool, because regardless of what we're doing now, heart disease is still killing the most amount of people compared to all cancers combined, all illnesses combined, and all diseases combined. So I hope that answered Paul's question. Tony, what do you think?
I think it has. But I think it leads to another question. And you talked a little bit about the calcium score. So can you talk a little bit about the calcium, cardiac calcium score? Because it's an interesting test from the standpoint that most insurances don't pay for it. I had one done. It costs $100. You go to it with your credit card and pay the radiologist, and they do the study. I keep hearing more and more about it, but why doesn't insurance pay for this test, as far as you know, and what is it?
Yeah, great. So let's start with what it is. So it's a very simple test. It's a CAT scan that we do of the chest. It's a low dose of radiation CAT scan. And basically, we put you in a CAT scan machine. We take a quick picture. Usually, it's under 5 minutes, 5 to 7 minutes of a CAT scan. And then we take you out. We then use a special computer system, and we actually calculate. We look at the arteries of the heart based on the calcium. And we say, okay, how much hard calcified plaque is in each artery of the heart. And, you know, the great thing about the coronary calcium score is there's a lot of data that's emerging. If you have a coronary calcium score of zero, then your risk of having a cardiac event in the next, you know, few years is very low. Now, that doesn't account for people who have who are smokers or have strong family histories, et cetera. There's some caveats to that. But overall, if you have a calcium score of zero, that's good news. Now, on the flip side of things, if you're getting a calcium score and you've got a calcium score of 400, 500, you know, hey, there's a chance that you actually have a more than 70% blockage in one of those arteries of the heart. And so I think a calcium score is a really great test. Like you said, it's, you know, unfortunately, it's not covered by insurance yet. And I hope that with time, insurance companies do start covering it more because it's in our guidelines. So, you know, calcium scores are in the American College of Cardiology guidelines on primary prevention. They're in our guidelines to look at these calcium tests. The insurance companies haven't gotten behind them yet. I'm not sure why, to answer that question. I'm not sure why. I wish they really did get behind these calcium scores because they allow you to better risk stratify. So you've got someone who otherwise is healthy and doing well, but they've got high cholesterol. It's not, you know, grossly high, but it's higher than it should be. We do the calcium score because they have intermediate risk, and we find that they have a calcium score of, you know, 100. Well, now, hey, we have plaque. It's already there. The cardiac disease is already there. And so I think, you know, I always say, I'm like, I think it's the best $100 you're going to ever spend if you're the right patient population. Now, calcium scores are not the best test. If you've already had a stent put in, if you've already had bypass surgery, it's not the right test. A calcium score is really a test for someone before they have their first cardiac event. It's really for those people that were saying, hey, how aggressive do we need to be in terms of your cholesterol management and optimization?
A couple of terms you've already brought up. So we talked about hard plaque, but you also mentioned soft plaque. Can you explain the difference and how the soft plaque impacts cardiac disease?
Absolutely. So, you know, hard plaque is plaque that has been calcified and hardened. And now the nice thing about they're not great. No plaque is great. But one of the better things about hard plaque is that it doesn't necessarily rupture as often. And it'll build up and it will cause angina or chest pain because of lack of blood flow to the muscle of the heart. Without necessarily, it might not cause that acute heart attack that we all, you know, see in movies and whatnot. Now, plaques that are mixed, which means they have soft and hard components to them, they have a higher increased incidence of rupturing and causing that acute heart attack that we see. Those softer plaques, we don't see those on a calcium score because they're soft. They're not solidified yet. They're not calcified. But those plaques often can lead to an increased risk of having an acute heart attack or that, like I said, you see that someone on TV who all of a sudden, you know, grabs their chest. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't have that with a hard plaque, but it's less likely than with the soft plaques.
What's the ideal blood pressure now? Because that number keeps changing and it keeps going down. So what's an ideal blood pressure for someone to have?
An ideal blood pressure, Tony, is less than 130 over 80. So when you're reading a blood pressure, you get two numbers. You get a top number and a bottom number. The top number is what we call your systolic blood pressure. We want that less than 130. So I really want to see that in the 110s, you know, low 120s, things like that. Less than 130 over 80. The bottom number, that diastolic blood pressure, I want that less than 80. That's the new ideal blood pressure. And it's interesting because in years past, we used to say, oh, well, if you're of a certain age or getting older, we can tolerate a little bit of a higher blood pressure. That actually is not the case anymore. You know, we have really good data and the recommendations on blood pressure, even in patients over the age of 65 or over the age of 70, is still less than 130 over 80. Now, we know that untreated blood pressure can lead to heart attacks, stroke, and even increased risk for dementia. And so increasing our stringent kind of technique to get that blood pressure lower is going to be really important.
So let's kind of moving on a little bit. We hear a lot about different devices, implantable devices, right? We have pacemakers,
yep.
Defibrillators, and I've had several questions in the past about them. Can you explain the difference as to what they're used for when someone has the and some of the relevance between the pacemaker and the implanted defibrillator?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's really important to recognize that they are different devices. So a pacemaker, what it does is it actually paces the heart. It allows us, if someone has a heart block or a heart rhythm that's very slow that needs to be fixed because it's not sustainable, and it, people aren't, someone is either passing out because of heart block or if they're having electrical issues, we use a pacemaker. A pacemaker, what it does is just paces the heart, and it gives you that regular heartbeat that you're looking for or that we expect. Now, these devices are incredibly smart devices, and, you know, we can alter them to make sure that they increase if you're exercising, et cetera. But a pacemaker simply paces the heart. Now, a defibrillator, on the other hand, a defibrillator is a device that we mostly put in patients who have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. So in patients who have a weak heart muscle or the left ventricle is weakened and isn't pumping the way it's supposed to be pumping, there's an increased risk for life-threatening or dangerous heart arrhythmias such as ventricular tachycardia and ventricular fibrillation. And there's an increased risk of something called sudden cardiac death when you have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, if it's significant. And so in that patient population, we use a defibrillator. Now, defibrillators are placed, and although they look similar to a pacemaker, they function differently. What they're looking for is they're watching for those dangerous heart rhythms, and they're going to kick into action if you have a dangerous heart rhythm. They're going to try to get you out of it first with just pacing you or making sure you're overdrive pacing you, which is complex in itself. So they're going to try to get you out of it first. But if it can't, what it's going to do is it's actually going to deliver a dedicated electrical shock to the heart to break that dangerous or life-threatening heart rhythm to allow your native, your natural heart rhythm to start back again. And so the defibrillators are a life-saving device in patients who have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or again, that left ventricle that pumps poorly, because those are the patients that are at increased risk of having either sudden cardiac death, ventricular fibrillation, or ventricular tachycardia. Now, there are some patients who have irregular or dangerous heart rhythms without having a weak heart. They also may end up with the defibrillator. But a defibrillator, like I said, is very different from a pacemaker. A pacemaker cannot shock you or get you out of that dangerous heart rhythm. The defibrillator is what acts on ventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation to be your life vest or your life-saving, you know, agent in that patient population. And so that's how a defibrillator acts differently than a pacemaker. Now, defibrillators also can pace. And so, you know, if someone is getting a defibrillator, sometimes it is used to also pace the heart into a normal rhythm. And there's a whole complex, you know, downstream of multiple different types of, you know, defibrillators and pacemakers. But that's kind of the high level difference between your defibrillators and your pacemakers.
Stephanie, thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
You're very
today.
Welcome.
I'll have to get you back on. I have so many other questions regarding heart disease. And you've given our listeners so much to work on. So thank you. Thank you for your time today. And thank you for everything you do for our community and in your role as Director of Women's Heart and Wellness Program at Hartford Hospital. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today, Tony. It was really great to talk with you. And you know, I'm glad that we're able to get out the word of how important heart disease awareness is, and, you know, giving people that information is just important. So thank you for having me on today.
Thank you. And if you wish to reach Dr. Saucier, it's 860-972-1695. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the podcast at odyssey.com or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.